Welcome to the latest episode of the Pay and Proxy podcast. This is Meredith Irvine, editor of compensationstandards.com. Today, my guests are Keith Halverstam and Maj Bosegi. Keith and Maj are partners at Latham & Watkins, and they are the global chair and vice chair, respectively, of Latham's public company and board representation practice. The Latham team recently released a client alert with practical considerations and frequently asked questions about the Dodd-Frank clawbacks rules. And I'm very thankful they're both here today to discuss clawbacks with me. Welcome, Keith and Maj.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we jump in, can you both start by just telling our listeners a little bit about yourselves?
Sure. And you just did most of that for us. But I am Keith Halverstam. I am a capital markets and public company partner of Latham based in New York and the global chair of our public company and board representation practice, and really split my time between doing deals and running what for us is an interdisciplinary group of our capital markets, our public company, our corporate governance, our benefits like Maj, our partners and our litigators who focus their time on how to comprehensively represent public companies, particularly on all the new and tricky issues coming down the pike like clawbacks. So we're lucky enough to now represent about 1,000 public companies. It's the largest public company practice in the world, and bring together resources like Maj, who you'll meet in a second, to really address the things we're talking about today in detail.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maj Bosegi. I'm a compensation and benefits partner at Latham in our Bay Area offices. As Keith and Meredith mentioned, I'm also a global vice chair of our public company and board representation practice, which really is an interdisciplinary group which tries to target issues like the clawback rules that we're going to discuss today from many different angles, not just a public company angle, but a comp angle and a securities litigation angle. I primarily work with public companies in my practice. I also do deals and some private company work, but my focus is public company representation from the compensation and benefits side.
Great. So happy to have you both here again. So as I mentioned, you recently released this client alert. It has a lot of great FAQs on the process of adopting a policy, but I really want to move forward to your discussion of restatements. I think there's been a lot of consternation about the circumstances that trigger a mandatory clawback. And, you know, the SEC previewed this with their reopening release, but they really changed and took a more expansive view of what constitutes material noncompliance with any financial reporting requirement in the final clawbacks rules. Can you walk us through that? And I'd say with that in mind, discuss what companies should be doing now and potentially what they should be doing in terms of process improvements going forward to make it less likely that they find themselves dealing with a restatement and with then a mandatory clawback.
Sure, Meredith, happy to. And I think, as you indicated, this is in many ways the most complicated and trickiest aspect of the rules and is getting the most attention. And it starts easy, and then it gets more and more complicated and starts having a lot of traps for the unwary, which we'll do our best to point out. So it starts easy because it starts with the concept of big R restatement, which is basically at the heart of these rules that have been hovering for over a decade since they were initially required under Sarbanes-Oxley. And the big R restatement is the more straightforward and understood part of the rule, because big R restatements have existed for a very long time. And the basic concept is that if there is an error that is material to the prior period financial statements, a whole series of things happen that public companies are familiar with, some of them much more familiar than they'd like to be. Things that are all predate these new clawback rules, right? You have to file a Form 402AK. You have to restate and reissue the financial statements for that prior period. You have to label that restatement as restated and comply with a whole bunch of other stuff that's in ASC 250. And it's often messy, and it's often ugly, and it often delays your public company reports. And of course, now it gets worse because it ties to clawbacks in the part that people always assumed would be the case, right? So in the simplest case, you have an executive who earned a certain extra amount of compensation because certain financial targets were met. A restatement occurs. It turns out, oops, those financial targets were not met when we restate the financials. And so we are going to claw back the compensation that she or he received. People may love or hate that, but they get it. It makes sense. And it ties to an area of accounting that long predates clawbacks. But the SEC, in these final rules that were then adopted in their form by the stock exchange, went much further and did something with respect to what we call a little r restatement or little r revision that is very different from what existed before. So what is this so-called little r restatement or revision? Well, again, this concept has long existed, and it's an error correction that's not material to the prior period, but is material to the current period financial statements. So everybody who reads this for the first time is like, that makes no sense whatsoever. How can something not be material to the prior periods and then suddenly it's material now? And the short version of that, of course, all the accountants on the phone understand, is the things accumulate over time on certain balance sheet or income statement items and suddenly become material. But before these new rules kicked in, all of this also kind of fell into the who cares securities doctrine. As long as you were out of this awful and scary big R restatement, if you had a little R restatement, you know, weren't thrilled about it, but you didn't really care. You did it. It existed in the new financial statements. You didn't have to put out an 8K. You weren't calling into question your old financial statements. Therefore, your stock probably is not dropping. You're not getting sued. All that parade of horribles is off the table. And so nobody really thought much of it. Now, suddenly, if you're in this so-called little R restatement, and there's a great flow chart in our client alert that kind of shows how you land there, you got to look back and say, hey, just as with the big R restatement, this little R revision or restatement, if it moves the number across the threshold, that's how our executive or executives got paid, we've got to claw back the compensation. So suddenly it's way out of the who cares doctrine, and it's we care a lot because it affects our compensation. So that's the sort of first part of this whole analysis. Then there's the second part, which kind of runs into your question, Meredith, about what can companies do wrong. There's a whole bunch of other categories, and I'm not going to go into too much depth. It's all in our client alert. But there's stuff that's even more innocuous than the little R restatement. You can have an out-of-period adjustment. Sometimes companies just do voluntary revisions because they think it's better disclosure. Or often companies will just decide, hey, this error is totally immaterial and there's nothing that needs to be corrected. So why do I go into this? For two reasons. The first is that until a couple of weeks ago, whether something fell into that little R restatement category or an out-of-period adjustment was a decision accounting groups made, but without any consequence whatsoever. And so there's a lot of stuff that probably got called a little R restatement that didn't need to be. And so if we think about what can companies do, the first thing is you suddenly got to be almost as careful about those little R restatements as you are about the big ones. Don't inadvertently call something a little R restatement that's not, because it could trigger your clawback. And the second is, I mentioned all those other categories, the green boxes in the client alert we did. Companies have been very loose with language. Companies have often called out of period adjustments, little R restatements. Don't ever do that again, because suddenly your executive's compensation is at risk of clawback when it doesn't need to be. So again, what we're telling our clients to do is not only to make sure you're going through this, and all the people on the podcast are, of course, being very careful about it, but make sure your accounting groups, really down to the people who are doing the work on the ground, are very aware of this and don't make mistakes early on that inadvertently land at a little R revision or call something a little R revision that's not, and then suddenly you're in clawback land when you don't need to be.
It's a great point, just to use the right language in your disclosure and also in your documentation. Yes, always important, more important than ever now. So skipping ahead to issues around enforcement, can you walk us through the steps that a company should take under their clawback policy once it determines that a restatement is required?
Sure. So let's say you are in the unfortunate situation where you have either a big R or little R restatement. At that point, the company internally, and in some cases with the counsel or other third parties, needs to determine if they have incentive compensation that was tied to a financial reporting measure that was impacted by this restatement, or if they simply have incentive compensation that is tied to stock price or TSR hurdles. That's the pool of compensation that is potentially in purview. Once they determine that, they have to determine if any of the current or former executives received that type of compensation after October 2nd, 2023, during the applicable three-year period. And this is important because a true three-year period is actually not going to come into effect until the restatement determination is made in 2027 or after, because we're only looking at incentive compensation received by these executive officers after October 2nd, 2023. So once that determination is made, they have to actually calculate, well, what was the excess or erroneously awarded compensation? because only the portion that would not have been earned under the restated financial is the portion that the company is required to mandatorily claw back. And we'll get into where that's actually much easier when it's a revenue or EPS or other financial measure, but much more difficult when it's a TSR or stock price hurdle, where you're trying to assess if it would have been met or not met if the restatement had not occurred. Finally, sort of the last step, and these are limited, is to determine if any of the impracticability exceptions apply. And for U.S. companies, really the only one that could potentially apply for U.S. executive officers is where the company determined the actual direct costs paid to a third party to try to recover this excess or erroneously paid comp is actually larger than the recoverable amount. But to make that determination, first, the company has to make reasonable attempts to recover the amount. They have to keep documentation, and they have to provide that documentation to the exchange and describe in their Form 10-K or proxy statement that they've made this determination and how they arrived at it. So it's not that simple to make that impracticability determination. If a company determines that the impracticability exceptions do not apply, then the company does have to move forward with recovering the compensation reasonably promptly.
Yeah, and I want to stress a point Maj made. There is nothing more vital as you begin to put these clawback policies in place. And of course, you have to have them by December 1 or all sorts of bad things happen, including possible delisting, of being ahead of the game. So all the people on this podcast are ahead of the game, but is your board familiar with these rules? Is your accounting staff familiar with these rules? And are you thinking about clawback implications early on? As a public company, you never want to be in a situation where you're reversing a determination purely because your CFO is then going to get to keep her bonus from 2 years ago. But you can think about that early on and make sure you're not going down the wrong track. So the importance of coordinating with your legal advisors, your accounting advisors very early on today, and then certainly if there are warning signs of things like this, can really save the day and save your officers' paychecks ultimately.
Absolutely. I want to move on and talk about the difficulties associated with certain financial metrics because, you know, this erroneously awarded compensation can't be or isn't determinable by a simple mathematical recalculation for certain measures. Can you discuss what those metrics are and then the issues associated with those?
Yeah. So if this all seems really simple so far, now we get to make it complicated and move to the advanced class. So Maj's examples were great because they're relatively straightforward, particularly if you're at least in the big R restatement. You miss revenue, you miss EBITDA, you miss a clear financial metric target, and you've got to go look at the clawbacks. But the SEC and the stock exchanges didn't make it that easy. They also looked at metrics, most importantly, stock-based metrics and total stock return metrics that are much harder to determine. So what do I mean by that? Well, now the rules are in effect. Flash forward to next year. You thought you met the revenue target for your officers' compensations, and you didn't. We get all that. We may not like it, but we get it. What about if you have a restatement that results in lower revenue, lower net income, lower EBITDA, whatever it is, and your executives were paid compensation because there was, let's say for simplicity, a $10 hurdle on the stock price. You ended the year at $10.05. Now you got to go think, well, would we have met that stock price had our restatement happened before? And of course, the answer is it's extraordinarily hard to know. And this is going to be one of the trickiest issues of clawbacks, particularly if you combine that with a little R restatement, which is going to make it double messy. So the good or bad part, depending on how you look at it, is there's a whole industry that looks at these questions in the context of litigation, right? A, B, and C happens to a public company. Is that attributable to an increase or decline in your stock price? There's an analytics industry that exists to look at that, and they're all going to do very well out of these new rules. So that's the first part. The second part is be very careful where you concede these points because it's not straightforward. And then we don't have our litigation partners on this call, but the third thing they will tell you is this is very similar to loss causation in security suits. And so don't be so conservative on your clawbacks that you say, hey, we concede this is why our stock price went down or went up or was too high, because suddenly you may have just conceded causation for purposes of a securities litigation. So all of this ties together, and that's on the simplest total stock return metric. Maj, maybe you want to talk about what happens on some of the more complex ones that you create for our clients.
So a lot of the TSR structures we use in incentive compensation or PSUs don't just look at a single stock price as of the closing date or point in time, but rather they measure stock price over a 20 or 30 day period. So this issue becomes not only determining what the stock price would have been as of a single point in time, but really over that 30 or 20 day weighted average period.
Of course, it's not all or nothing. You may determine that, you know, 20% of the stock award was incorrectly awarded. It gets more and more complicated as you dig into this.
Yes, it does. So just to move on to collection to keep us talking about other topics as well, can you walk us through some of the complications on collecting excess compensation?
Sure. So Meredith, one of the primary concerns that I think executives have with this rule and that we share as their advisors is that the excess compensation has to be recovered on a pre-tax basis. So you could be in a situation where an executive has already paid potentially upwards of 50% of that compensation to the IRS already, and yet they have to turn around and repay the full amount back. What can be done? One way to do this or to mitigate this issue is to put in place elective deferral options where the executives essentially elect to defer the payment or settlement of the incentive compensation, which is the taxable event, until after the expiration of the three-year recovery period. Now, whenever I say defer or deferral arrangements, you're within Section 409A of the code. So you obviously have to work very carefully with your outside counsel to put these arrangements in place. It might be especially helpful if you do have TSR or stock price targets, because those do get trickiest under the rules. The other issue is, well, what if this is sort of forward planning? What if you're in a situation with prior incentive compensation where taxes have already been paid? What can executives do? And there is Section 1341 of the Internal Revenue Code. So Section 1341 is designed to allow a taxpayer who receives income in 1 year, but repays it back to the company in the later year, to be in essentially the same position as not having received the compensation at all. That sounds great, right? And the code works by allowing either a tax deduction or credit in the year of recovery. Why can't everybody use this Section 1341? The reason is it's very fact specific, and we don't have a lot of guidance on it, or any guidance on it, frankly, under the SEC mandated clawback rules. But we do think that there will be fact patterns where potentially executives and their advisors can get comfortable relying on this. It's sort of to be seen, and it'll be facts based on each circumstance.
But I think the technical word about all this is it's going to be a mess. Because compensation is going to get clawed back on which individuals have already paid tax. All the complications Madge runs through are going to exist. He or she may not have the liquidity to pay back that compensation, especially if they've already paid tax, and especially if it takes the IRS 10 years to figure out what Madge has already figured out. It's going to be ugly. And of course, companies cannot lend money to their executives and so forth. They're not going to want to lend money to their former executives. Again, this can get messy really, really fast. And we think it will in some instances.
But we have this mess. It's a scary mess for executives, right? This is a no-fault, mandatory clawback, pre-tax basis. Can companies do anything to reduce the impact here for their executives? Can they, you know, for example, use indemnification? And could they advance expenses? On that last point, I've kind of seen different perspectives on that. So I'm curious your thoughts there.
Sure. So there's a whole bunch of things here, and half the answers are yes and half the answers are no. So let me try to sort of hit them in some order. The first one is the rules are very clear that companies cannot indemnify officers against the clawbacks. We just cannot do it, period. The rules say nothing about advancement. Our view is that advancement should, and in fact, in many cases, is required to continue in ordinary course. I would say our view is not without its detractors. I think it's the matter of some discussion and we will see how things play out. But our current advice, and we're happy to talk to people about this in more detail, is that advancement is appropriate and currently, and maybe sometimes required. Two more pieces of this: acknowledgments. I don't want to go too long into this, but there was a recent case about clawbacks predating these new SEC rules where an executive basically said, I don't care what the clawback policy says. My contract doesn't say I have to give back the money. And the court sided with the executive. And in fact, in certain states, probably California and some of the East Coast states, there are questions under employment law about whether the clawbacks are enforceable. So there's a very reasonable position to say, okay, let's close that loophole and amend our employees' contracts, ask them to sign form of acknowledgments that basically says, yeah, I raise my hand. If you try to claw back, I will write you a check. But there are some very, very good arguments on the other side of the rules do not require acknowledgments. This is a whole other podcast, but these rules may get knocked down by the court. There are a lot of reasons executives may not want to sign acknowledgments, and there are a lot of very reasonable positions boards can take in the context of their business judgment that acknowledgments are not required. They're trying to attract top talent. These rules may not be enforceable. Some of the clawbacks are discretionary. So we're really advising people to talk to us before determining whether acknowledgments are appropriate, because there are good arguments on both sides. And then the final piece of this, which I'll let Maz address, is you can start thinking about, do you want to change your metrics, given what the clawback rules say?
And that last one, I think, is a really good point. And I think we've been a little slow to do that. I think we should encourage our clients to really be looking at their comp programs. I've heard, well, no one's doing it, so we shouldn't do it. And that's not the right answer. The right answer is there a way where we can modify your program to mitigate this clawback issue, but still have all of the incentives in place that we need, still have a program that investors will be happy with? And there are ways of doing that. And I think companies can work with us and their comp consultants to make tweaks to just make their programs a little bit more palatable under these rules.
And then finally, I wanted to ask one more question, and that is about a hypothetical that your FAQ document poses, which is where a company needs to recover shares that were erroneously earned, but they've already been sold and they were sold at a gain. How should a company be thinking about that scenario?
So this is a really interesting one because the SEC flip-flopped a little bit on this one. So if you go back to the proposed SEC release, they were actually really clear in that release that gains on sales of shares. So these are shares with underlying awards that became erroneously paid or excess comp. And in those proposed rules, they were very clear that that gain on the sale of those shares needs also be recovered. But they stepped back in their final release. In the final release, they provide that the determination is going to be based on the facts and circumstances. And they go further and say that they believe companies and their boards are actually in the best position to determine whether they're going to go after the gains or not. So it's really going to be a case-by-case determination based on the company's board's exercise of their business judgment and their fiduciary duties.
Meredith, that ties back to a question you asked before. As companies think about, do we want acknowledgments? How detailed should they be? Do you agree to stand up in the middle of the field on Yankee Stadium and wave your hands and say, please take my money back? Or is it something less than that? Right. It all goes to Maz's point. So there's a lot of discretion here. And whether your board wants to pre-enforce all that on its executives is not an easy discussion and one you should be talking to outside counsel about.
I mean, public companies are grappling with so many new issues right now, but I personally think the implementation issues with clawbacks are one of the trickiest topics that companies are going to have to be working through. Companies that face a restatement have to be working through in the next couple of years. So I think we're going to be talking about this for a while.
I think they're some of the hardest, the trickiest, the most controversial, the most statutorily subject to challenge. And of course, most importantly, they go to your executive officers and your officers' paychecks. So people are really paying attention.
That's right. Well, thank you so much. I was so happy to have both of you here to talk about these topics. For our listeners, the Latham Client Alert that we've been discussing actually addresses 24 frequently asked questions. We only addressed a handful of those today. So I do highly recommend that you read the whole alert. It has more information on timing considerations and disclosure requirements, a longer explanation of the restatement and recovery process, and a great discussion of risk mitigation measures. You can find that on compensationstandards.com under our clawbacks practice area and also on the Latham website. Thanks everyone for listening. And thanks again to Keith and Maj for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Meredith.